Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Musician's Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Mark, and I'm super stoked to speak to the one and only Will Martin today. Will Martin is a songwriter, singer, life coach. Most people will know him from the band Earshot, who were massive in like the early 2000s kind of era. They're still doing massively well. They're about to embark on a new tour. Hits the road 28th of September. If you haven't got your tickets yet, go get them. Will was super gracious with his time in this interview, so I want to publicly say thanks, Will. I appreciate it, dude. As usual, if you're enjoying these, please leave us a rating or review. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Will Martin.
This is Will.
Hey, Will. It's Travis. How's it going?
Hey, Travis. How are you today?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Man, just getting busy.
Yeah.
Just started getting into the day. Lots of stuff to do today.
And you're gearing up for tour as well, so I imagine the last minute things before that starts to happen always feels like they come real quick, you know?
Yeah, no, it's starting to feel that way. Like there's still a few things that I have to tie up, and I feel like I'm running out of time, even though I have a few weeks, I think, left. And then also too, you know, there's the typical, like, am I forgetting something, you know, type thing. There's always,
totally,
always that. Yeah.
Will, so a bit of a strange thing that I get to get all my guests to do is while I will record an introduction in post all about you and your shots and all the things you've done, and obviously I'll put all the links in the descriptions and stuff like that, I typically ask everybody I interview to give a brief introduction yourself. That way our listeners kind of maybe get a better idea as to where you're coming from during the course of this interview, rather than me just kind of hyping you up and then no one really knowing anything from your side. So if you wouldn't mind,
gotcha.
Tell us who Will Martin is.
Wow. This might take a few podcasts to do, actually. Well, let's see. I was originally born in Kansas City. Or in Kansas, I should say. I grew up in LA. I started playing guitar when I was 12. My dad's also a professional musician still. Started singing right around the time this band formed. This is actually the first band that I started singing in. And lo and behold, we got our first record deal with Warner Brothers, and that happened pretty fast. We put out two records on Warner Brothers, the first one Letting Go, and the second one called Two. We had some singles off of both of those records. I then went and started writing for The Silver Lining. In 2007, we put that out. We had yet another falling out with the label that we were on at that time, Universal. And at that time, I kind of took a step away from music for about almost a decade. And in that time, I went into production. I started learning production. So I went to work as a contract employee for Live Nation for about 7 years. And I learned all about production, and I was stage managing and doing production managing work. I worked with a lot of big bands, from Korn to Kelly Clarkson to Goo Goo Dolls to you name it. I've probably worked it. From there, I went into tour managing, where I tour managed a handful of bands, notably the Misfits, and Peter Murphy and the band UFO. And shortly after that is when we reactivated Earshot again. However, then the pandemic hit right as we were getting ready to get started with that. So during the pandemic, I was asking some friends of mine. I said, knowing me, if besides doing music, knowing me, what would I be doing if I wasn't doing music? Like, what am I good at? Just trying to, you know, because we couldn't tour, obviously.
Of course.
And the thing that came back every single time was a life coach. And that's something that, you know, I've been doing. And my mom's a phenomenal life coach. And so I grew up around that environment as much as I did around my dad, who was a musician. So, you know, I've kind of innately been that for my friends. And when I thought about that feedback, I was thinking back to the bands that I'd worked with, which, you know, the few bands that I just mentioned that I tour managed were, you know, historically difficult bands to work with. In other words, they've been through a lot of tour managers and just very challenging to work with at times. And I didn't have as much problem with that. And I think what I was doing at that time without really knowing what I was doing was I was coaching them. I was talking to them and I was able to relate with them because I knew and understood their anxieties of what they were experiencing out on the road. And I was able to talk about that and talk about options. And so when I got that feedback and I thought about all of that stuff that I was doing, it made sense. So then I went to school during the pandemic because, like everybody else, there was really nothing else to do. We were writing music as well, but so I went to school. I enrolled in the school and graduated that about a year later and became a certified personal development coach and executive coach. And so that's also what I do on the side. And I love the work. And I work with business owners and entrepreneurs. I work with regular everyday people. And I'm also starting to now work with artists. And so here I am now, you know, sucked back into, you know, to the earshot thing. Now we have it was supposed to be a 2-week tour and it turned into a 3-week tour because we kept getting promoters writing in, seeing that we were booking shows. And so now it's 3 weeks and we could have probably gotten 4, 5, and 6 weeks, but, we had a lot of prior commitments already on the calendar. So we had to cap it at 3 weeks, but we're going to go out and do some stuff hopefully next year. But so here we are, you know, about 3 weeks out from leaving on this fall tour with a couple of really cool small bands that I think people will really love. And yeah, that's the Reader's Digest version of Will Martin, I guess.
That's awesome. And, you know, I love the fact that you went into the production stuff and the tour manager stuff and even the life coaching stuff, because there were some questions I wanted to ask about that, but I've kind of put them all towards the back because I was like, man, you know, let's talk about some of the band stuff and the music stuff first. Maybe you wouldn't want to talk about that. So we can definitely go into that now because you've opened the door. Woohoo!
There you go. You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, so you mentioned that your dad was a musician and that you kind of picked up guitar pretty young and that Earshot were the first band you were singing in and stuff like that. So I don't mean for this to seem like an ignorant question. Obviously, if you got your deal pretty quick, that might be the answer right there. But just in case it's not, what was the situation or when was the moment that you thought to yourself that music could be your career? Or were you always going to head down that path because you'd pretty much grown up around it?
Yeah, I hated school. I liked, you know, hanging around with my friends and all of that, but I just wasn't interested in what, you know, I was being taught. I mean, obviously I wanted to learn how to read and write. You know, those things I went to, but, you know, all the other stuff, you know, history, and I mean, and I sat through some of that too, but it was, to me, it felt, you know, as a kid even, it felt a little, or a lot, I should say, redundant. And I just wasn't interested. When I first picked up the guitar at 12, I knew at that moment that music was what I wanted to do. And I knew that it could be done because my dad had supported us, you know, since I was little, growing up, and he's still doing it. And that's all he's ever done, is a professional musician. So I knew it could be done. I also saw how hard a work it is, you know, to be in the music industry, and it's not always easy. And there's a lot of challenges associated with it. So I was aware of all that. I would say I knew right from the start when I picked up the guitar that that's what I wanted to do. So much so that about a year or two later, I kind of just stopped going to high school. Like I just knew that that's what I wanted to do. And of course, that drove my parents absolutely fucking bonkers. But I was just so impassioned and hyper obsessed with music and the guitar. And I think a lot of that has to do with what, you know, music was able to do for me growing up.
Yeah.
And my connection to it and the ability for music to connect with me and make me feel not so alone in the world. You know, it was like a friend that I always could call on. All I had to do was, you know, pop in a CD or a tape or turn on the radio, and, you know, there's the old friend.
Exactly. I've actually had that discussion before, so I don't mean to jump in here, but with the way that music gets digested now, and I'm stereotyping, of course, because there are always exceptions to the rule, but I sometimes wonder if music is still as important to so many people. Because like you just said, I felt pretty much the same connection. You know, like whenever I was sad, music. Whenever I was angry, music. Lonely, music. It was just always there. Like I joke around with some of my friends that like a guitar has been my best friend, because it's like I've spent more time with it than any actual human. But like I just sometimes wonder, because I mean a few weeks ago during one of my interviews we were talking about streaming and stuff like that, and we got into the topic of, you know, just how that works and how albums aren't necessarily listened to in the same way, and so on and so on and so on. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, this wasn't something I was actually going to go into with you, but what are your thoughts on how music is digested now? Do you think people are still getting that close of a relationship with music, or do you think it's fewer? What are your thoughts?
Well, no, I mean, obviously, you know, once record stores went away and you couldn't walk into a record store and actually touch and feel and have in your hands, you know, the tangible physical piece of music or plastic or whatever it was that you bought, and then handed over your money for it, you know, and then went home and tore off the wrapper, you know, stuck the CD in, or vinyl. I know vinyls kind of made a little bit of a comeback, but it's pretty small blip,
yeah,
comparatively speaking. But, you know, you pull out the liner notes where I listen to it, you're looking for the lyrics, you're looking for who produced it, who mixed it, you know, any kind of information that you could glean that gives you any kind of insight, you know, into this band that's sort of an enigma of sorts, right? And now that's all kind of gone away. It's all there. Everything's there. You know, the way music is marketed is, you know, it used to be advertisements or magazines. You know, you had to read interviews in magazines or listen to the radio to catch an interview with an artist to, again, just capture, you know, something, an idea about the band, because you wanted to know more about them. You wanted to know what made them tick. You wanted to know what they were like, you know, what they sounded like. And in today's day and age, all that is pretty accessible now. Like, you, if you're not doing those things voluntarily, you're kind of not falling in line with, you know, with what's happening. And then you kind of go to the back burner and you lose traction. So I would say that, in my opinion, although I'm not saying people don't have a relationship with music, because obviously if you have a favorite song that even you're streaming, you obviously have a connection to it.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to hear it. But I think it's not the same connection that it used to be when, as I described earlier, when you used to walk into a record store and hold that record in your hands and buy it with your hard-earned cash and go home with it and sit in the, that kind of intimate interaction and experience with is sadly gone. And that is kind of disappointing to me. However, I'm a huge proponent of technology. I bought the first iPod back when it came out. I had a digital MP3 player before the iPod even existed. Creative Labs made a device that looked like the size of a compact CD player, and you could only load like 20 or 25 songs on it at a time, and you had to load it on via PC. And I remember I took that on a trip, and I was ecstatic because it meant for me that I didn't have to, you know, drag along. I'm sorry, it's 20 CDs and not 20 songs. I didn't have to drag along, you know, CDs and lose them or scratch them, or inevitably somebody wants to borrow one and then they don't put it back, and then you find it in a cushion somewhere 2 months later and it's all scratched up.
Yeah.
I was fascinated with the technology that you could do that, and it sounded better than radio. I mean, radio is really compressed. It is definitely not the best sounding medium of listening to music out there by far, but it sounded better than that. Not as good as a CD quite, but it was good enough. And I loved the idea of being able to make your music portable without having to drag and damage the actual physical media.
Yeah.
And then when the iPod came out, you know, you started to be able to load more and more content on it. And now we're streaming. And even when streaming came along, I was fascinated with the idea that, wow, like, I don't even have to, you know, import and go through the process of putting music onto the player. Now I can just connect and listen to my music on demand. And in the beginning, it was sort of okay, although we had sites like, I can't even remember the name of this, like Napster, that were allowing people to share music for free that way. That was kind of the undoing of what in the beginning was, I think, a really good idea, which was you could either transfer the music that you already had, or you could buy it and have it on your device. That all made sense. But when it got into Napster and a whole host of other, you know, piracy sites, that's when I think Spotify, you know, sort of saw the way forward with what we have now, which is streaming, which was, hey, people are going to steal it, so let us stream it. And we'll give you a little something, but it's better than nothing. And that's where I kind of got soured on things with streaming. I love the idea. I don't like the execution of it.
Yeah, I have to agree, unfortunately. Great concept. Just, there needs to be an improvement some way so that musicians could actually, you know, pay their bills, You know, the fact that some of these people, and I get that when you add all the millions of streams across all the networks, I get that you can still make a lot of money. But for the average artist who's not necessarily like a Taylor Swift kind of artist, the fact that you can get hundreds of thousands of streams and not even be able to pay your distribution costs, that can be a bit like, what? You know, anyway.
I mean, to make a living off of streaming music, you would literally have to be, you'd have to be an artist in the billions of streams.
Yeah.
You make a little something if you're doing in the millions, but it's not enough to, it's not a salary that you could live off of, you know, even pretty good. Like, it's just not. I know there's a big, you know, sort of misconception about, you know, the kind of money that artists make. And some artists do make a lot of money, but it doesn't come from the places where they think, I think. And I think there's a lot of disconnect between, you know, how people think the music industry works and how artists are getting paid and what really is happening. But why would they? I mean, if I'm not a musician and I'm not in the music industry and I, you know, am a mechanic, why do I care? Why would I be interested in looking into any of that? So, I mean, I get it. I don't blame anybody for not, but but it's still something that a lot of artists are up against and don't realize how important it is, especially when a band goes on tour. That's really all artists have left at this point is touring. And that's why when the pandemic happened, that hurt a lot of bands. A lot of bands were really, really affected by that. The bigger ones, not so much. Obviously, the Metallicas and Taylor Swifts aren't, you know, they're fine. But the smaller and medium mid-tier bands, those are the ones that got hit hard. And that's why it's important. You know, the touring industry is really the lifeblood nowadays for nearly every artist.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Well, on that note, and we'll get to the touring thing in a second, but let's talk about Earshot for a bit before we go into too much of the music life kind of stuff, if you will. I've got a couple questions. The first one is, you know, obviously Earshot, even with your break, Earshot's been around for quite a while. I mean, you guys officially came out like 99, 2000 sort of time. And you yourself have been the one real constant in that band. So if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about, you know, how you stay positive when you're in a project and members have to change, whether that's through your choice or their choice. And I know that it happens in both scenarios, but let's for sake of the podcast, let's say you've got a member who you feel is a really good fit and you guys bring out the best of each other in that particular project. And that member decides to move on, do something else, maybe has a different opportunity or something suits their life better and they move on. How do you, as the spearhead of a project, personally stay positive in that situation?
You know, I think that, you know, going back to my childhood upbringing, sorry, I'm still waking up over here.
Hey, it's totally cool.
You know, my mom was a single mom, after my mom and dad, when I was 7 or 8 years old. And, you know, she was working 3 jobs and going to school, and it was me and my little brother, and we were constantly moving. And every time we moved, that meant having to go to a new school. And I was always kind of a introvert as a kid. I was pretty shy. I didn't talk a lot. I was very observant. And I remember I always, you know, anytime we moved, I would get a little bummed because I'd have to say goodbye to the few friends that I did make during the 6 to 12 months that I was there, and have to do all of that awkward, you know, stuff again with, you know, new classes, a new school, new teachers, and you know, trying to figure out who I'm, you know, friends are and try and fit in somehow. So I tell that story to say, I think that that, oddly, now that you asked that question, kind of prepared me a little bit for that. I get it. So anytime there's been a situation where a member has had to move on, whether by my choice or whether by theirs, I get it. I just get that change happens. And I know that because I lived it. I grew up with it. And I understand that things run their course sometimes. And you have to move on to new things. And yeah, it can be awkward. And it can be inconvenient, which it always was. I remember when I was a kid, it was inconvenient. It happens. And so I think that sort of prepared me to deal with that. So I think that to me, it's like changing schools, to be honest with you, and having to make new friends and say goodbye to old ones. Very good question, though. I like that.
Actually, great answer as well, to be fair. I mean, I'm a big believer in that sometimes without us realizing, life is preparing us for stuff that we don't always understand. And
yeah, absolutely.
And like that stuff like that just is it's on the money, man. I like that. Okay, well, secondly, let's talk a little bit about touring. So at this point, I mean, touring's second nature to you. I know you're going to leave again sort of towards the end of September. This will be out around that same sort of time. But could you share any sort of touring advice with us, whether that's from a health point of view on how to stay healthy or even just any advice, how you think you could get the most out of a touring situation if you're new to touring or a new band going on your first tour, just any points from touring that you would like to share?
Well, obviously, I mean, the best way to learn is to be out there. Like, you just have to jump into the frying pan and you got to get burned and fried a few times, unfortunately. That's how you learn. Aside from that, you know, your best friend in a tour is being organized. And thinking of the things that can go wrong and having contingency plans as much as possible, because things will happen and they do happen and they can happen. That's not to say that there will be, but again, it goes back to being prepared. And I preach this a lot of times and talk about this when I'm coaching a client or talking to a smaller band or artist about being prepared. And I think being prepared, when I talk about that, really applies to everything in life. You can only be successful as much as you're prepared. And if you're not prepared and the opportunity comes, then that's one way you can fail. If you're prepared and the opportunity comes, your chance for success is a lot greater. That just goes without saying. So being prepared for things, particularly with touring, is a really, really big thing that I would say is, and being organized is the two biggest things that you should really strive for. And then once you're out there, of course, you know, being disciplined and executing the plan that you have and just trying to manage expectations and manage situations and getting in front of things as much as possible. But doing that requires knowledge of being on the road. And so for artists that don't have a lot of touring experience, aren't going to be able to wrap their head around that as well, or be able to handle that aspect of it as well as someone like myself or somebody who's, you know, toured a lot. So that just comes with experience.
Yeah, that makes total sense. How much of your touring manager role, like with the Misfits and stuff like that, how much do you take to Earshot? Do you head that up to save on costs when Earshot's touring, or do you employ a tour manager and then they worry about that and you worry just about being an artist?
Well, on this one, I've pretty well orchestrated, and it's still in the process of orchestrating how this is rolling out and advancing shows and et cetera. Only because it you know, saves us a little bit of money, and it's something that I already know how to do, and I've already done a gazillion times. But I have a you know, a small team of people around me as well that are helping me, you know, with other, it's really tough to do everything because we're also trying to make a new album at the moment as well. So, so I do have, you know, a small team of people kind of helping me fill in the blanks and plug the holes, you know, where I haven't been able to fully focus. But yes, to answer your question, on this tour, I'm, you know, doing those duties. And I'm pretty sure once I get out, the way that I do things, the amount of preparation and thought that I put into it, pretty much when this tour starts, it'll pretty much run itself the way that I have it set up. And yeah, I'll be there obviously to fill in any blanks. And again, I'll have, you know, a couple people helping out on the road and or remotely, you know, sort of helping to fill in any, you know, loose ends that maybe got missed, but it should pretty well, you know, run itself for the most part.
That's cool. Goes back to your being prepared sort of synopsis stuff, you know? It's good.
Yes, 100%.
You mentioned the new album. I want to talk about your songwriting process. I mean, you guys, I've been a fan for years. I know we didn't talk about that the first time we spoke on the phone, but like Two and Letting Go and of course Silver Lining and stuff like that. I love it all, but I was a fan early on. So when I had the opportunity to do this, I was like, well, sweet. But nice. Let's talk about your songwriting process. When you're in your kind of situation, and what I mean by that again is with you being the constant, in my eyes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in my eyes, I would imagine you are the one bringing most of those creative ideas to the project, and then the members are doing their parts. But really, I'm imagining it's more of a, and I'm paraphrasing here in terms of my example, but I'm imagining it's like more of a Trent Reznor kind of situation where you are really the, and I'm not trying to downplay your band members, please don't get me wrong, but I'm imagining that you are the one heading it up. You're the spearhead. You're the, this is the song, let's make this a song kind of guy. I could be wrong, but just talk us through your process. Is that, are you bringing the idea to the table and then the band filling in the gaps? Are you sort of saying, hey, I want you to play this kind of thing? Are you splitting songs equally amongst members? What's your process? What's the business behind it like?
So it's sort of varied from album to album. The first record, you know, when it was myself and the bass player who was the original founding member along with me, he, on the first record, wrote a lot of the music ideas. And I write all of the lyrics and the vocal melodies on everything, but musically speaking, and I'll stick with that. Musically speaking, our bass player at the time wrote a lot of it, and it was really interesting stuff. And when you listen to Letting Go, there's a, you know, it's very, he was a big Bauhaus fan. Mm-hmm. And he was also a big Tool fan, which I wasn't a huge Tool fan, but so he had Bauhaus, Tool, and Deftones. Those were his three bands that he was really into at the time. And I think that's why that record came out so unique, so unorthodox. And I remember when we were writing those songs, I remember going like that, there's nowhere for me to sing in any of this stuff. It's so busy and it's so so off the wall. Like, I don't even know what to do. And I was trying to make it more musical because I'm more of a songwriter. I'm a Beatles, Led Zeppelin. And he was more mathematical. And so we battled, creatively, a lot. And letting go was, every song on that record was the result of a compromise. And I think that's why that record came out so unique.
Yeah.
And I love that record.
It's a great record.
There's so many cool moments on that record. Like, I was just listening to that and I hadn't listened to it in a long while. I was listening to it just a few days ago and I was just hearing things and there's just so many cool little things in there that just, I went, wow, like that. And so on that record, that was myself and the bass player. On the second record, where we moved on from the original bass player that I started the band with, was kind of when I was sort of responsible for the direction and the writing process of the band. So I had to kind of step up in pretty short order and sort of find our way artistically, stylistically. And so two was a lot of like, that was, if I were solely in charge of making an Earshot record, two is probably as close as you're going to get. Cause that's, I would say that's around 90% musically. That's around 90% myself. And again, the lyrics I've done pretty much. I mean, I do all the lyrics and melodies on all the records, but that record, I mean, Letting Go was great. I love to, I mean, we had a lot of fun with that record because we were experimenting a lot with sounds and different guitars and different amps and different drums. And we had so much time, Warner Brothers gave us a lot of time to just, to make a great record. And that's what we did. And we went in and we just poured our hearts and souls in that record. And it's a fantastic record. And it's no surprise that, it's the most listened to album of ours, to date. And Wait just keeps growing and growing. I was just telling somebody the other day, Wait, I feel like is more popular today almost than it was then when it came out, which is crazy to me. But it sounds great. It still sounds relevant. And I think that's the key, when you write something that's truly great and impacts people in a meaningful way, I think it does the proverbial standing the test of time, and it's always relevant. Just like, a Black Sabbath record is relevant today, even though it was recorded in, 1976, still relevant today. The Silver Lining was, a hodgepodge, of myself, the original founding bass player, writing a few of the songs with us. We had some newer members also that had a little bit different influences than I had, which, by nature got incorporated into the process a little bit. And that came out very unique. And those three records, Letting Go, Two, and Silver Lining, I mean, you couldn't have, three records that were more different from each other. I mean, I was pretty much the only, common thread through those three records, but stylistically speaking, different. And I've always embraced that. Like I, people always, you know, labels would go, write us another hit, like Wait, Get Away, Not Afraid, and Headstrong. It's like, well, but we already wrote that song. Like,
exactly.
I don't want to set out to write, you know, the same song over and over and over again. Like I want to be able, I'm an artist. So I want to like, I want to color outside the lines. I want to try different colors. I want to try different size canvases. Like there's, you know, same concept. And so I've always embraced, you know, being a little bit different, while still trying to, you know, maintain, you know, the things that our fans loved about us in the first place. I think the silver lining, the in a way, was probably the most out of the three records where we started to kind of move away from the first two records that fans really came to know us by. And maybe I went a little too far off the deep end for some of our fans, but it's necessary for an artist. I tell, you know, I talk with artists all the time, you know, if the only way to grow as an artist is to go outside of your comfort zone and risk, you know, being different than what you thought you should be or what other people thought you should be or should be doing. It takes courage to do that.
Oh, a lot. That's a very brave thing to do.
100%. So, I mean, for us and for me as a person, as an artist, like, you know, we were doing what we wanted to do, and that's how we've arrived, you know, to where we're at now. And I had to go through that. And this next record that we're working on, oh, and I skipped over Aftermath. Aftermath was an EP, and that was sort of some leftover songs from Letting Go and Two that didn't quite make it, that I wanted to, that I thought were great and just needed to be finished up. And so that's what I did, and I put that out just kind of as a stopgap.
Okay.
Cut to 2018, new band, new guys. Wasn't even really thinking about putting and reactivating the band again, putting music. It literally started very organically with me, Mike, our drummer, and Andy at the time, and a promoter at a club in Las Vegas called Counts Vamped. And they, one of the promoters there, kept emailing and emailing and emailing our website email asking if we'd come play a show. And I was, the first one, I think I ignored. The second one, I said, hey, listen, we're not currently doing any shows. And he wrote again, and I think I ignored that one. He wrote in again, and I said, listen, I don't even have a band right now together. Like, and it turned into a little back and forth exchange email. This gentleman saw us a show of ours in Florida back in 2002 when we were out with Filter. It was us and Filter on tour at the time, and we were in Orlando, and that's the show where Filter had to cut their tour short because Richie had admitted himself into rehab and he went away for a little while. And so we finished out that tour on our own. But he had been at that show, that last show, and it was a disaster of a show for Filter. Like, it was bad. And so he was emailing me that, and we were kind of reminiscing on it. He said, hey, you know, not for nothing, but get the band back together. I'd love to have you, you know, come play Vegas. We've got this club here called Counts Vamped. It's great, blah, 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 blah. And so I was happened to be talking to Mikey and Andy at the time, and I was telling him about this. And so they were like, well, let's do the show. And I was like, what are you guys talking about? Like, why don't we just, we'll, you know, find a couple more guys and let's just go do the show and see what happens. And so that's how this whole thing started again. Like, it was very organic. I had no plans to do anything at all. And again, we played, that was our first show in Las Vegas. And so I credit them with, you know, pushing us to reactivate. And it kind of just made me feel the love and the passion for it all over again. And as we started to build and we started to evolve, that's when we, you know, Aaron had reached out to me. I'd met Aaron back in 2004. We were doing a bunch of shows with Breaking Benjamin at the time, and we just clicked and hit it off, and we hung out all the time. When we weren't on stage, we were listening to music, sharing music, sitting in the back lounge of our buses, like smoking cigarettes till 3-4 in the morning, just trading tracks, like, check this song out, check that song. Oh, that's cool. Dude, check. Have you heard this person? Oh, dude, that's cool. Like, just back and forth, like, really obscure music too. Like, of course we were, you know, playing stuff that, you know, most people love, but, and so we bonded then just musically and as people. And then in 2018, when we were looking for a second guitar player, he hit, and I hadn't heard from Aaron. And I mean, sporadically, we'd send a text back and forth like once a year or even every couple years. At this point, though, I don't think I'd heard anything from him for a few years, actually. And when we were looking for our second guitar player, he sent me a text and he said, "Hey, I was wondering if you'd be interested in singing on a track that I wrote for my solo project. Let me know if you're interested and I'll send you the music." And so I was like, "Oh my God, this is funny." So I texted him back and I said, "Yeah, no problem. I'll send me the track. I'll check it out, sing on it." And then I just popped the question and asked him and told him what was going on. And he didn't even hesitate. He was like, "Yeah, I'm in.
That's awesome.
Let's do it." So, everything just happened super organically the whole way through. And, it feels good. And now we just went to Florida. We had planned on recording this record, back in 2020, but then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So we recorded some singles, you know, remotely, because we all have our own little studios, and put those out. But once everything got, you know, opened back up again, we just met up last July. We flew out to Florida to our drummer Mike's house. He's got a big house right on the water there. He's got a recording studio there. And we just all met up there, and we spent 12 days and wrote and recorded 11 really, 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 really great songs. In fact, I was just telling somebody the other day who they were telling me how great of, you know, they still listen to Two all the time and they love that record and Letting Go. And I said, "Listen," and you know, I'm my own worst critic. I said, "If you like Two and you like Letting Go, then you're going to fucking love this record."
That's
like,
cool.
It is the, what I would say, the perfect hybrid of both records. And that's what makes me really ecstatic about this record, because I love both those records. They're kind of a little bit night and day, stylistically a little bit, or sonically, but all of that is just mixed in the pot now. And it sounds really, really great. And I really like it because it doesn't sound really like anything else, the way that anyone else is doing it, I should say. So I'm super excited to get it out there.
I'm excited to hear it, man.
Spring. Yeah, it's going to be great. I can't wait.
So I've got a bit of a strange one to ask you. And I'm kind of like just skimming through what I've got left, because I want to respect your time, obviously. So I don't mean to jump all over the place, but if you wouldn't mind indulging me, that'd be great. We were talking about what made you choose music a little bit earlier. I'd like to put a little bit of a spin on it. You know, obviously you've now been doing the music thing for decades. You've been doing this a very long time, your whole life. You grew up with it. You know, we've spoken about that. If possible, and it's a bit of a loaded question, but what do you think has been the hardest part about being a musician, or at least having a career as a musician?
Staying optimistic.
Good answer.
Is the biggest challenge. And I don't think, I know it's a struggle for a lot of artists out there. Even the ones that people know and love, it's still a struggle. It's hard. We're at a time in the music industry where, we touched on a little bit earlier with streaming, and you know, no one's really making a living off of that except for the top half of 1%.
Yeah.
That's the tough part. I know that a lot of bands, a lot of, you know, the bands that I know that are out touring, like, deal with the same thing. They deal with, are we gonna make any money? Or forget about, are we gonna make any money? Are we gonna make our money back that we invested to get this tour going? You know, people don't realize is that before we even leave, like, we're already paying for the bus, we've already paid for all the merch, like, there's already a lot of money invested before the tour even leaves the parking lot. So so that's the stressor, the optimism. You know, every band wonders, like, are we going to sell enough tickets? Are we going to sell enough merch? Are we going to do good enough for the promoters happy to where they even want to have us back again? And that's before we even get to the part about, hey, how's the show going? Like, there's so much other stuff happening. And so that's, I'd say the second biggest challenge is getting rest, because when you're thinking about all these things, it's really hard to sleep.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's, you know, sadly, why a lot of artists, whether they realize it or not, why a lot of them have addiction problems. I was certainly there at one point, you know, so I understand, you know, the first thing you want to do when you can't sleep is find me something to knock me out, you know, give me booze, give me pills, drug, whatever it is that, you know, the drug of choice. This is how it all spirals out of control. But it has to do with, you know, the optimism and the challenges and the thinking associated with, you know, how difficult it is out there right now.
And, you know, for the listeners who do want to go down the music path, specifically the ones who want to focus on trying to be songwriters or more specifically, even further, songwriters involved with bands, is there something on the business side that you would suggest they focus on early on? You know, I know, again, we spoke a little bit earlier, like you were saying, certain things only come through experience. And that's, you know, that makes a lot of sense and will apply, obviously, to answers like this as well. But, you know, given how your career has gone, are there any things that, looking back, you had wish you had known more about at a specific time, or you had to learn the hard way, that you kind of ever thought to yourself in that moment, man, if only I knew a little bit more about this now? Did that ever happen? These are some heavy questions. I do apologize.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I got it. You know, there's a saying that I heard a while back, and I use it to this day, and it really applies to this business and to your question. You know, to start with, before I answer that, I'll preface it with, you don't know what you don't know until you know eventually, right? So my answer to that was going to be, you have to really be aware of being short-sighted. And you couldn't know that until it's happened. You go, oh, well, if I had looked at the long game, maybe I would have handled that situation differently. Fuck. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, you know, when I look, a quick example of that was when we did our deal with our second record label, which was spearheaded by my then manager, who was one of my good friends and confidants. And he, without his contribution, you know, we probably wouldn't, you know, be talking about Earshot today, and there wouldn't be any Getaways and Waits that people would have heard of. He was very instrumental with this project, and I still credit that, even though we don't work together and we've just recently gotten reacquainted again and speaking. But, you know, we were talking about it, and after I hung up with him the first time that we spoke, and I talked to my then attorney at the time, who I still stay in touch with, you know, we were reminiscing about how tough that record deal was to get done. And part of it, you know, without getting into the gory details of it, was because there were certain things that were promised to me that weren't initially in the deal. And I was offended by that. And I was hell bent on having those things, even though those things that he had promised before had changed and shifted to where he couldn't. But I was more offended with the fact that he didn't at least tell me that. You know, I got it in a contract. That's how I learned that it had changed. So yeah, that's what made me feel a little bit slighted. And I was in a different headspace then too. I was really sort of depressed over the whole Warner Brothers breakup debacle, and feeling very indignant about that whole situation at that time too. So that didn't help matters. So I just remember at the time, you know, instructing my attorney, like, listen, fuck this. Like, I can't believe he's, you know, after all this shit that I've been through, like, he's pulling this shit. I want that. Plus I want this, 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 this. And of course he came back and said, you're crazy. But eventually he did it, because he needed to deliver a record to Universal, and he wasn't happy. And that's when our relationship took a turn for the worse. He wasn't happy. He didn't feel like it was a good deal for him. I, on the other hand, had an amazing deal, and I was super happy. And we were celebrating and, you know, doing the toast. And what eventually ended up happening with the silver lining, even though Misunderstood was at radio and doing pretty well, the record went away. And the reason why was because he didn't feel like there was nothing in the deal for him that made him wake up every day and want to
work on it.
Work hard. Right. And so when I was talking to my attorney after I'd, you know, spoke to my manager, who I hadn't talked to since then in 2007, my attorney actually said to me, he said, you know, he said, I give speeches at universities, you know, for music entertainment classes, and I go and speak, and he goes, and I actually use you and your band and that whole deal as an analogy. And he goes, the lesson that I try to teach people with that is that there is such a thing as a deal that is too good for the artist. He goes, because you had an amazing deal. Like, you got everything in the kitchen sink that an attorney would ever want to get for his artist. He goes, but what we didn't think about, and I finished the sentence for him, I said, he didn't get to win along with us. He goes, right. He didn't get the win. And that's why he kind of just let it die on the vine. Like, he's just like, well, there's nothing in it for me here. You got everything. It's like a bad divorce. Right. Yeah. So and now, as soon as he said that, and I thought about that, if I wasn't being so short-sighted, then who knows what could have happened with that particular record. I could have compromised and said, fine, that's fine, change it. And hey, if the record does as well as we all think it's going to do, then we can renegotiate then. And see, but I was too short-sighted at that time because I was too distracted with, you know, all the anger and indignation that I had going on at the time with several other things that I couldn't see it then. But in hindsight, and I always say hindsight's 20/20, and still I need corrective lenses sometimes.
Very nice.
Is that short-sightedness can get you into a lot of trouble. And it's tough. I didn't know that then. I didn't realize it then. So again, you don't know what you don't know until you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's some deep stuff, man. I'm enjoying it. Listen, Will, I know that we're going over time here, but I'm going to ask you two more questions if that's okay with you.
Sure.
The first one is, if you were to launch a band now, so let's use Earshot. Let's assume you guys have the knowledge, the know-how, the expertise that you have, but maybe you just haven't actually gone down the path you have. You're a new band, but you have the knowledge. What would your approach be on trying to launch such a band nowadays?
Well, you want to find people that are going to be in the trenches with you, 100%. That are willing to be in the trenches, because it's a battle. It's an everyday battle. It's an everyday struggle. You have to have everybody in your camp has to be 100% committed to pulling the rope in the same direction. Above and beyond that is really focusing on the music, because unless you have great music, none of anything that I could tell you matters. If you don't have music that connects with people at a visceral level, be creative, be experimental. Don't be afraid to sort of carve your own path. Be willing to fail. Be willing to take criticism. Be willing to not be liked by everybody. Be willing to be hated. You have to be willing for all those things, or it's going to be a rough, bumpy ride. But don't let those things deter you from going down, you know, where your instincts tell you you should go. That would be my advice to somebody that were starting a band today.
Man, and I think you kind of answered what was going to be my last question there too, so I don't think we even have to go into it. I was going to ask what do you think has been some of the best pieces of advice you've ever received, but you ended on such a positive there that I don't know if I even want to go down that road. So,
well,
yeah, go for it.
I can give you an answer. There's actually an answer for that. I'll share with you an answer that David Kahn, who was then vice president of Reprise Warner Records, who signed us and who also produced Letting Go. He gave me a piece of advice that I still to this day share with new artists that I work with. And it has stayed with me since the moment he said it. And when he said it to me, it just fucking resonated so loudly. And I went, wow. And as time has wore on, man, was he ever right. Mind-blowing. And his advice to me as a new artist, I'll kind of set the scene for you here a little bit. So yeah. We were in New York City. It's during 9/11. We were mixing our record. Andy Wallace was mixing, and 9/11 just happened to happen when I was there mixing our record. So I was trapped on the island for 3 weeks there when that was happening. But so we had gotten through 9/11. We finally got the record mixed, and me and David were standing outside. It was drizzling rain. And he said to me, kid, you made a fucking great record. You have a fucking great voice. You have a really promising, bright future ahead of you. He goes, but I want to give you one piece of advice. I said, sure. He goes, create art that people either love or hate. That's what you want to do. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, what I mean is, he goes, you can create music, and if people love it, then it's going to go far because people are talking about it and they love it, et cetera, et cetera. Likewise, if people hate it, they're going to talk about it and people are going to want to hear for themselves. He goes, but if you create art that is in the middle and doesn't cause a reaction one way or the other, that's apathy. And you don't want apathy. He goes, because apathy is that song in the background when you're at a bar that you don't even know who it is. You don't care who it is. You're just talking right the fuck over it.
Yeah.
Create things that people love or hate. And that has stuck with me. And everything that I do, if people say they love it, I'm happy. When people say they hate it, it hurts. But I love it. Great. I'm glad.
That's awesome.
So that would be my biggest piece of advice that I would share and pass along to other budding artists out there. And I would say also that applies to pretty much anything in life.
Yeah, I think you're on the money, man. I think that's actually very true, you know. All right, Will Martin. Dude, I can't thank you enough. I wish yourself and Earshot nothing but success on the new tour. 28th of September, I believe you guys go out.
Yes.
Dude, been a fan for a long time. It was an absolute privilege speaking with you. Thank you so much, sir.
My man, thank you so much. And thanks for thinking of us.
Hey, anytime. Peace. There we have it. Will Martin, everybody, from Earshot. Make sure you check out Earshot at earshotband.com. Make sure you check out Will Martin across all social media platforms, W-I-L Martin. Super cool guy, super prolific, calm, nice energy kind of dude. Again, I want to thank Will for his time. I want to thank each and every one of you for your time. Thanks for continuing to listen and support the podcast. Got some super cool guests coming up. Which, you know, leads me to once again asking you to all leave us a rating and review because it helps us get even better guests. My name is Travis Mark. You can find out more about me at travismark.com. You can find out more about The Musician's Mentor at musicians-mentor.com. Until next time, keep pushing. Peace.